Pin number 322. Brother Russell gives the suggestion that these jewels have been being prepared for the full period of the gospel dispensation. And that this expression, "I will spare them as a man spareth his own son that serveth him," has the significance that God, in dealing with those that are his jewels, will see to it that no trial or experience shall be more than they can bear. He will permit trials to come. He will permit difficulties to come. But in all of these, he will be with them. He's not going to keep them out of the difficulties. He did not keep those three Hebrew children from going into the fiery furnace. But while they were in the furnace, there was one like unto the Son of Man that appeared in their midst and was with him. And so in all of the trials of our lives, we have this assurance that if God permits anything to overtake us, that he will overrule it for our highest good. The Greek text of Romans 8:28 is just a little different from what it reads in our ordinary common version. Instead of saying all things work together for good, it reads God works all things together for good unto those that love him. So whether it be something that is good and in which we can take enjoyment and are pleased and happy, or whether it be something that be in the nature of a storm or a trial of life, it is a part of the all things that God causes to work together for good, as it were, to those that love him and worship him in spirit and in truth. But Brother Russell in the same article suggests that these jewels are being prepared for a future use when they shall all be gathered together. And this, of course, presupposes that each and every one of those who is represented by these jewels has had a part in the first resurrection. Now, of course, this is a very, very sweet thought, that there are jewels in the course of preparation for a future work. And in what sense would jewels be used beyond the veil? Well, of course, we recognize it would have to be figurative in the same sense as it speaks of certain ones who would be weeping and who would have their tears washed away from their eyes. The great company will come to a consciousness of the fact that it has lost the great Christ of the high calling which is in Christ Jesus, joint heirship. But God isn't going to keep that before them forever. To the contrary, he's going to wipe away those tears from their eyes. They're going to have a blessed and honorable position. They're going to have service before the Lord. And this, of course, will keep them happy and rejoicing through all the ages of eternity. But we were thinking in particular, dear friends, of the high priest of old. On his shoulders he had two precious stones, and there were 12 of them in a breastplate. And on these stones were engraved the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. Now these stones were very precious in themselves to the ancient high priest, but they were doubly so inasmuch as they represented the 12 tribes, the children of Israel, who constituted the camp. It is said that the high priest wore this breastplate over his heart. And Brother Russell also makes the suggestion in the Tabernacle Shadows that while the breastplate represents the law in two of its aspects, the spirit and the letter, that it is that which is the spirit of the law that bears the jewels. And this, of course, is very, very significant then, dear friends, because while in one sense the world's high priest will be constituted of Jesus the head and the church his body, there is also a sense in which Jesus himself is the world's high priest, and the church constitutes that breastplate of judgment. It's the glory, as it were, of the priest. Brother Russell says that among the garments of glory and beauty, this was one of the most beautiful of all. Now, dear friends, the reason that we make reference to that ancient breastplate is because of the fact that we believe that those things were all typical. And even as we speak of the world's high priest, he is the antitype of Aaron. So we're going to speak of an antitypical breastplate adorned with jewels. These jewels that are spoken of here in Malachi, "And they shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels." Now, dear friends, unfortunately, we do not know exactly nor precisely what the stones were that were in that ancient breastplate. Oh, yes, you'll tell me that in Exodus it tells you the names of these stones. But we are not sure, since the meaning of the Hebrew words have been completely lost, as to whether what the translators have put in there are the correct words which would respond to the gems that adorn the high priest's breastplate. Now we say, dear friends, that the ancients did not know anything about crystallography, that is, about the crystals and the prisms that are formed to make these gems. They didn't even know what the chemical constituents were of these gems. And so, to them, a stone that was beautiful because it was red, purple, green, and had a luster. So you see then, dear friends, that is the reason we say that we can't be too sure of these stones that are given to us in the book of Exodus as being the right ones. And I don't think it's necessary that we should know them. But not knowing what the stones actually were, nor the crystallography of the elements which made those stones, I think it would be presumptuous for us to give a discourse basing it upon the crystal formations of these stones. Now we say, dear friends, that as we've gone into this matter of these ancient stones, the very first stone mentioned in the Hebrew account, in the Hebrew tongue, is Odem. Well, that's the word from which the word Adam has been translated. Odem means the same as Adam. And what does Adam mean? Reddish. so it would be a reddish stone. But there are four or five different stones that could be reddish. Which one would it be? And so you see that oftentimes the Hebrew word merely had reference to the color, to the tint, to the shade, to the luster. It wasn't that you could say, well, it was a sapphire, or it was an opal, or it was a diamond, or it was some other stone, a ruby, topaz, sardius, chalcedony, or anything like that. You couldn't be sure of these things. But one thing we can be sure about, we now know of what those gems were made, whether they were one form of a gem or another form of a gem, we know what they were made of. These gems, with the exception of the diamond, are all made from oxygen, silicon, and aluminum. These combinations we call silica and alumina. The diamond is a crystallization of pure carbon, and it is hardly possible that a diamond may have been one of the stones in the original breastplate, because they had no means of engraving the diamond in those days. It's only within the last 100 years or so that chemistry and the science of crystallography have enabled us to make a precise classification of these stones. But the ancients didn't have these. But since we don't know this, what we do know is basic, and that is that each and every one of these gems had as a basic ingredient silica or alumina. Now, the reason I bring this to you, it's like the first chapter in the 6th volume. Some of you can read it and enjoy it. Others of you will just read it and pass it over. This discourse today will be of the same order. In other words, you may not be able to take all of it in. It may involve too much that is scientific or academic. If you can't take it, just leave it. But get the spiritual import of it when we bring it to your attention. Now, we have found that the most common elements in the crust of the earth are oxygen, silicon, and aluminum. And they constitute 82% of the earth's crust. And you'd think, since that is the basis of gems, that there would be a lot of them. But not so. Gems are rare, because they are made as a result of intense heat, such as prevails in the bowels of the earth, where the rocks are in a molten state, and high pressure, which forces them through the fissures and the crevices in the earth's crust. And then there must be the slow cooling process. Now you see, dear friends, despite the fact that these elements are preponderantly present in the earth's crust, only a few become gems. And let's see the parallel, dear friends, with the Lord's jewels. If there's anything more common in this world than the poor, I'd like to know it. Certainly no one will deny the fact that there are more poor people than there are rich. And while the rich are not excluded, our Lord did indicate that it would be mighty difficult for the rich to enter the kingdom of heaven. How hard it is for the rich to enter the kingdom! And this richness of which we speak is not necessarily one of wealth as we ordinarily understand it. It can be of wisdom, of knowledge, of understanding. It can be of ambition. It can be of physical health, all of these may constitute our wealth. And you remember that since richness is not necessarily a matter of wealth, but it can be health or ambition or anything else, we're not at all surprised when Jesus says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Blessed are the poor in spirit. Now, we don't mean by that that blessed are the poor in spirit, but blessed are the poor in spirit. Those who are meek, lowly, and teachable, these are the blessed ones. Now, the world is rich in people that are poor, but it isn't rich in those who are poor in spirit. Now you'll see then, dear friends, already there is a parallel. Insofar as these earthly gems were concerned, which adorned the breastplate of the ancient high priest, they were made of the most common elements in the earth's crust. Yet how scarce they were. And those that are the Lord's jewels are taken from the poor of this earth. Not many wise, not many prudent. But there are a lot of people in this world that aren't wise. There are a lot of people in this world that aren't prudent. There are a lot of people that are poor. But only a few become jewels that shall be mine in that day, when I make up my jewels. And what is the reason? We've already endeavored to bring to your attention how these gems of old were the result of intense heat, great pressure, and a slow cooling process. And these jewels that are to be the gems of the Lord, they shall be mine, saith the Lord, in that day when I make up my jewels. It is true of them too, dear friends, that they have been formed in the trials in which there's intense heat and great pressure of circumstances, in all of which they are rightly exercised. They cool off slowly. In other words, the same material that you find anywhere else in the world, but these, under the pressure of circumstances, under the heat of trial, are rightly exercised, and as a result of this, they develop into a beautiful crystallized character. A character, a crystal, a gem, worthy to be enshrined and enclasped in the golden ouches of the divine nature. Now you see then, dear friends, the beautiful parallel that we have. While we don't know the exact names of the stones, we do know how those stones came to be the stones, the gems that they were. And while you and I don't yet know our place in the kingdom, and whether we are scarlet, whether we're blue, whether we're purple, or whatever else color it may be, we don't know these things. But yet we're in the course of being formed into these jewels, which the Lord says shall be mine in that day when I make up my jewels. Or maybe suggest when he makes up that beautiful breastplate of the antitypical high priest. Now, when these stones were formed as a result of the peculiar combinations of these elements, they had a natural color. But sometimes the color was augmented by the presence of some accident, or let me put it this way, by the accidental presence of some other element. And so far as these ancient stones were concerned, it might have been chromium. It could have been iron. It could have been lithium. It could have been manganese or magnesium or titanium. It could be any one of these. If they were present at the time, they would add color to the stone. And so, dear friends, while all of the saints have a beautiful character, a beautiful color, which is the result of withstanding the trials, the heat of the trial, and the pressure of circumstances, and instead of becoming excited, they cool off slowly and gradually. That is what gives them the character that God is willing to bless with the office of the priesthood, one who was touched with a feeling of the infirmities of others. But in the midst of these trials, and incidentally and accidentally present oft times, is the element of misunderstanding, the element of reproach. Oh, it's easy enough sometimes to go through the trial. But when somebody misunderstands us, it's a little harder, isn't it? Or when reproaches come because of what we have done. Well, dear friends, that's all a part of the material that goes to coloring and giving the beautiful color and the tint of these precious jewels of the Lord. And we say then, dear friends, it's very, very interesting to note that these stones must each and every one have differed from every other stone in the breastplate. There was one, of course, that might have been red. Another one might have been green. Another one might have been purple. Another one might have been orange. All different shades, you see. But there were only 12 of them. And yet, they all differed. And when the 144,000 get together beyond the veil, there will be 12,000 this shade, 12,000 that shade, 12,000 another shade. And the shades varied and differed on the ancient breastplate, as did the names that were engraved upon them. The names which were engraved upon those gems, those jewels, were the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. Now here, dear friends, you see, again, we have a difficulty. Insofar as the shoulder pieces were concerned, the Exodus account tells us that the names of the tribes were engraved, 6 on one of the shoulder pieces and 6 on the other one of the shoulder pieces, according to the birth of the children of Jacob. Well, that's simple enough, isn't it? Because that account is given to us in the scriptures. The children of Leah, of Bilhah, Zilpah, and of Rachel, intermingled, interspiced. So we do know, but there is nothing that tells us whether this was the same order in which the names were engraved upon the stones of the breastplate. And in the Genesis account, it gives us 3 lists. The first of these is according to the birth of each of the children of Jacob. The second sets apart the wives of Jacob. First Leah, and then Rachel, and then it gives the handmaids. The last of these lists is the one where Jacob, from his deathbed, prophesies concerning each of his children. Now we say, dear friends, that there are three lists, but they're not all alike. Two of them, well, in fact, they all start with Reuben. Two of them end with Benjamin, but one does not. So you see, dear friends, even if we could be sure that the names were arranged according to their birth, we're not sure. Still, we do not know. Even Josephus gives two different accounts of that breastplate, in which the stones are still different again from what we have, you see. So all of these things give rise to a very, very beautiful thought. Nobody knows just how these stones were placed. Nobody knows how they were engraved. The old Hebrew method says three in the first row, three in the second row, three in the third row, and three in the fourth row. As far as the Jews are concerned, they would start numbering one from the right, one, two, three. You and I would start from the left, one, two, three. And there are those which go according to the Targums, which say instead of them being in four rows, one under the other, that they face the north, the south, east, and the west, so that the stones would be around on the sides of a square. So there's no unanimity there, you see. We can't possibly know. So where the scriptures are silent, we can conjecture. But if we do conjecture, we must make sure that what we're suggesting is not out of harmony with everything else that has been said on the subject anywhere else. Now we say then, dear friends, the stones on the breastplate were precious to the priest because they were precious stones, although there isn't anything in the Hebrew text that even suggests that they were precious in the sense that you and I would recognize preciousness today in a precise and accurate sense of the word. They were uncommon stones. They were rare stones. We know how they were formed, and we know that they were engraved with the names of the children of Israel. Now in the great antitypical high priest, his breastplate too will have 12 stones. And those 12 stones are those that are being prepared here and now, and who have been prepared all the way down through the gospel dispensation. They have been subject to the trials, the heat of trial, and to the pressure of circumstances. And if they've been rightly exercised, they've cooled off and crystallized beautiful characters. But on that breastplate, there will be engraved the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. Those stones in the ancient breastplate represented the camp of Israel, all of Israel. And the stones on the antitypical breastplate, while they themselves are the 144,000, even as those ancient stones on the high priest Aaron's breastplate were stones in themselves, what they stood for and represented the nation, so to our high priest, the stones of this breastplate, the church of the gospel dispensation, made up of these jewels that have been formed under these conditions, are precious to him because they are precious stones. but they're doubly precious to him because these stones will represent the whole world of mankind. Brother Russell says the time is coming. In fact, you have the suggestion in your Passover that the whole world will become the Israel of God someday. And as the Israel of God, they will constitute the people of the camp of God when the tabernacle of God shall dwell among men, and when the high priest, Christ, and the church will be present to pour out the blessing upon them. So you see then, dear friends, they shall be mine in that day. They're being prepared now, and they're developing a glory of color, of luster, a character, crystallized character, that makes them worthy to be set in the golden ouches of the divine nature. The interesting thing about it is, dear friends, that we have another listing of the tribes of Israel. And these occur in the 7th chapter of the Revelation. And here we no longer find Reuben as the first one. Reuben is the second. But the first one is Judah. And you will remember, dear friends, that in the prophecy on the deathbed of Jacob, he said concerning Reuben that he would not excel. Judah was a fourthborn. Judah excelled. The praise of God. The first position. Well, first of all, of course, we'll have to recognize the stones themselves, and then those for whom these, who are called the jewels of God, were baptized for the dead. In Paul's epistle to the Corinthians, where the matter came up concerning the resurrection of the dead, Paul in his argument uses an expression like this: if there be no resurrection of the dead, then why are you baptized for the dead? Brother Russell suggests that the saints of the gospel dispensation are baptized for whom? Not for themselves, but for the dead, so that you in turn might be a blesser, be a part of that great antitypical seed of Abraham that shall bless all the families of the earth. So first of all, we'll have to consider those who will be worthy to be the jewels of that antitypical breastplate. The 144,000. And they're made up of 12,000 of these and 12,000 of those and 12,000 of them. Brother Russell suggested that God originally had planned to have all of them from among the Jews. That because of sufficient number not having been obtained from them, the rest are being called from among the Gentiles. That's the reason you and I may go in to make up Judah, or Benjamin, or Issachar, or Manasseh, or some other tribe. The differences in our character will determine just which tribe we shall belong to. But there is another peculiar thing about this listing of the tribes in the book of Revelation. And that is this: that Dan is not listed among them. Dan has lost his place among the tribes of Israel. Evidently, there are some who were identified with Dan. In fact, all that are Danites, as new creatures, will have lost their place among the 12 tribes of Israel. The question arises, why? There's only one suggestion, dear friends, and that comes from the deathbed prophecy concerning Dan and the history of the tribe of Dan, which we have, which follows on, also in the book of Judges in the 18th chapter, from the first verse to the last of that chapter, which of course we will not have an opportunity to read. Concerning Dan, he says he'll be a judge of Israel. That may have reference to the judge, you remember, of the tribe of Dan, probably the most well-known of the judges, aside from perhaps Deborah. And that was Samson, you remember? Samson was one of the judges of Israel. He shall judge Israel as Dan, of course. And the rest of it goes along something like this. He is like an adder or an asp, a snake that bites the horse's heels so that the rider falls off. Well, if we use this in a spiritual setting, what is the result? Well, it's just this, dear friends. A serpent, of course, is the symbol of evil. Yes. A horse, Brother Russell said, a horse would represent a doctrine. There are those who will play around with doctrines, tamper with doctrines, to their own hurt, to the destruction of the new creature. And dear friends, there have been, down through the ages past. Even today, there are those who, tampering with the doctrines of the Lord Jesus Christ, to their own hurt, to their own harm. And the result is that whereas they once might have been identified with those 12 tribes who shall stand, they have lost their place, and there's no place where they could have gone except into second death. Now, if you read the 18th chapter of this book of Judges, you'll find that the tribe of Dan had been given a certain territory in the promised land, but under the conditions that they were to fight for it and make it their own. They were to drive out the inhabitants of the land. God says, I've given it to you, but you've got to drive them out. I'll give you the victory. But Dan never did do that. He failed. He never did get the victory over the land. He never really possessed it. And so what did he do? He sent out some spies one day into a section in the way, way up in the north. And he found that the people were too complacent. They were taking it too easy. They weren't worried about anything. They were far enough away from everybody else. And Dan thought, well, here, these people are not protected. We can go over, we can take this and make this our territory. And that's just exactly what he did. And in the account, it tells us about Micah, who had a Levite priest, and that these spies, when they came along, they noticed this priest. I'd like to read from the 18th chapter of Judges, the 4th verse. And he said unto them, thus and thus dealeth Micah with me, and hath hired me. I am his priest. Now, troubling you with all the rest of the chapter, you can read that when you have opportunity. We'll go down to the 18th and 19th verses. And this is what happens. These men go back and tell, of course, the Danites as to what's what. And it says, and these went into Micah's house, and fetch the carved image, the ephod, and the teraphim, and the molten image. Then said the priest unto them, What do you do here? And they said unto him, Hold your peace. Lay thine hand upon thy mouth, and go with us, and be to us a father and a priest. You see here, he's already beginning to tamper and meddle with the priesthood. This priest belonged to Micah. Micah had hired him. He belonged to him. And so they were telling him to keep his mouth closed. The priest shouldn't say anything, but should still be their priest. What a compromise of the truth. What a compromise of the spirit of the truth. Believe me, dear friends, there are some like that, perhaps today, and have been through all the age past, like Dan. They have had an original inheritance. The new creature hasn't overcome the flesh. And like Satan of old, as Isaiah tells us, I will ascend into the hills of the north. These Danites went as far north as they could go to appropriate a land that had not been assigned to them. And so they partake of that spirit. And in the 25th verse, and it says, And the children of Dan said unto him, Let not thy voice be heard among us, lest angry fellows run upon thee, and thou lose thy life with the lives of thy household. That was, of course, to the priest, you say. In other words, instead of listening to the priest to make manifest to them the will of God, they said, If you don't agree with us, we'll do away with you. And in the 27th verse, And they took the things which Micah had made, and the priest which he had, and came unto Laish, unto a people that were at quiet and secure, and they smote them with the edge of the sword, and burnt the city with fire. So you see, dear friends, here are the characteristics of some that will not be identified with the 144,000 that will constitute the 12 precious stones, the 12 tribes of spiritual Israel, who will stand for and represent the 12 tribes of Israel, the whole world of mankind. There are some other little features in here in this listing that we have in Revelation. We find that Manasseh is specifically mentioned, but Joseph is also mentioned. Well, you remember that Joseph had two sons. These sons were Ephraim and Manasseh. And Jacob adopted these two sons. And when the tribe of Levi was set apart for service unto the Lord, and to have no possession in the land, the very fact that Joseph could be represented in his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, kept the number of the tribes up to 12, you see. Now, you see, Joseph's name has dropped out, but Joseph is in there with a double portion. He's run over the wall, so to speak. And that's the prophecy that Jacob had made concerning Joseph. But in the Revelation, Joseph is back in there again in his own name. And Manasseh is left there. And the one that is left out, evidently, is Ephraim. And concerning Ephraim, the prophet says, Well, he's a cake that's not been turned. Did you ever eat a cookie or maybe a pancake or something that hadn't been turned. It isn't fit to be eaten, is it? It isn't fit for food. And here is the secret, perhaps. There are some who are called the one hope of their calling. But when there was the opportunity to stand fast in the trials of life, which would have given them a position, since they follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth, have taken a way of escape to avoid the trials and the difficulties, and have compromised. Such is the state of nominal Christendom, isn't it? I was to the barber the other day, and while I was there, the barber says, "I think God made it too hard for us to be Christians." But he says, after all, he says, "The white people are really the only ones that are Christians." I said, "What do you mean by that?" Well, he says, our religion, the Christian religion, is the only one that says, "Turn over the other cheek." And I said, "Well, will you tell me, have you ever seen anybody that says turn over the other cheek when something like that happened?" No, he couldn't remember anybody having ever done that. Well, would they be Christians? The line of least resistance. Follow along with the world, do what the world does, what the multitude does. No wonder Ephraim is sometimes taken as a picture of nominal Christendom. Well, there are those, and perhaps many of the great company are among these. They've lost their place among the 12 tribes, the 144,000. Oh, some shall be saved, but so it by fire. And it is possible that Ephraim will be turned over so that the other side will be a little burnt too. This we know, that if God has accepted their consecration, they will have to die, yes. And it'll have to be the body that is destroyed. Consecration meant either willingly or unwillingly. But it has to be destroyed. And so you see then, dear friends. Now, you'll notice then, dear friends, that as we consider that these stones of the antitypical breastplate represent the church of the gospel dispensation, the gems which were the result of having been taken from the most common element in the world, the poor of society, being subject to the heat of trial, the pressure of circumstances, and still cooling off gradually. And this is what forms the crystal. Anybody can get hot. Anybody can blow up. But they don't crystallize. Oh, no. It takes the cooling off to crystallize. And if you blow up in the air and get all hot and bothered, yes, you blow up. But there's nothing of character left. It's gone. The development of character lies in the fact that not only are you subject to the trial and to pressure, but also that you cool off gradually. And if with all these other things there are misunderstandings and reproaches that come upon you, these will add color to your character. And you, as a jewel in the golden breastplate of the world's high priest, will have engraved upon you, you will stand for, you will represent the world of mankind before God. Oh, dear friends, are you being prepared? Are you being molded by the trials and experiences of life? Do you have the pressure which causes you to ooze out and find a place that is nearer heaven. Down in the bowels of the earth, it was mighty hot there, but the pressure drove them upward where they crystallized. So, in all of these trials and experiences, you will find there is something that gradually raises you heavenward. And as you cool off in that upper atmosphere, you begin to crystallize, and the character is formed, such a character as makes the gem. There is another place where the church is spoken of as a diadem. That's a crown. But the particular one that we have before us at the moment is the jewels of the breastplate. So, dear friends, we have endeavored to give you something. We know it's a little different from the way in which you've generally heard these stones being spoken of, but I'm sure that you can see the spiritual import, how these stones are manufactured, and how they're being prepared for their place, and how they will have been engraved upon them the names of the world of mankind, as it were. You see, that is your baptism for the dead. The engraving was done before the stones were put in the breastplate. The engraving. You are now being given the privilege of being touched with a feeling of the world's infirmities, so that when the time comes, you'll be able to be a faithful and loving high priest unto the people. May God bless that to you.